The headlines, the European Union's Brexit negotiator says a trade deal with the UK still hangs in the balance. The UK becomes the first country in the world to authorize Pfizer-BioNTech's coronavirus vaccine for widespread use. And firefighters in Australia are battling to contain a massive bushfire that has been burning a popular tourist spot off the northeast coast for 6 weeks now. Our top story for this half hour. The European Union's Brexit negotiator says a trade deal with the UK still hangs in the balance. Michel Barnier has said differences remain on three main issues. He made the comments at a closed-door briefing to EU national envoys. The bloc's member states have expressed concern over the fate of a post-Brexit trade deal with Britain. They reportedly fear that the EU could clinch a deal at any cost. Britain formally left the bloc in January but remains bound by its rules until the transition period ends. On December the 31st, the two sides are discussing their future relations but are at loggerheads over a number of issues. We're going to further focus on that story. We have our correspondent Jerome Hughes, who's joining us from Brussels. We also have Saeed Pourreza joining us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Jerome. Talk to us about some of the concerns that the EU negotiators have at this point.
That's right. Well, from the EU side, there's no doubt there are still major sticking points in terms of, you know, you mentioned fisheries, the so-called level playing field, and also the way in which they can settle disputes. And as you mentioned as well, Barnier has been briefing via video link from London the EU ambassadors from the 27 member states and giving them an update on the latest state of play. You know, and in relation to fisheries, there are some capitals apparently across the European Union who are concerned that Barnier might be giving too many concessions, particularly in relation to fisheries, because we understand one of the things he's put on the table is to suggest that the EU would give up 18% of the value of fish that are caught by EU fleets in UK waters. And apparently that's not even good enough for the UK side. So that is still a major stumbling block. The UK wants autonomy. It wants to have sovereignty over its fishing waters. But the EU side certainly, you know, doesn't accept that fully. And I suppose it's a very difficult juggling act now that the EU has, because on one hand, it definitely wants a deal, of course. But on the other hand, there's a situation whereby it's saying that, you know, it cannot make it, you know, there has to be significant downsides to actually leaving the European Union. So it can't give a deal that is too good, because then other capitals across the European Union will be looking at that and saying, well, you know, what's the point in being in the European Union at all? But there are critics in the UK side, I'm sure you'll hear more about that now, who are saying that, you know, Boris Johnson's oven-ready deal is starting to look like a cold turkey at this stage, because they're claiming that his side are not ready for what will happen at the end of this month if they don't have a deal and when the transition period ends. And we could see massive on this side, and the EU side, we could see massive delays in terms of channel crossings. The UK gets most of its fresh food using the route across the channel crossings. We could see major delays there. So, you know, downsides for both sides, but the EU is insisting that the UK has more to lose than the EU.
Let's cross over to Saeed in London. Saeed, it's great to have you with us. I hope all is well with you. Let's talk about the UK side. The UK's insistence that it needs to be able to set its own environmental, labor, and social standards without any prior approval, that still at this point remains difficult. Is there a quick fix to these differences, or are the two sides just too far apart?
Good to be with you, Barry. If there were a quick fix, they would have found it a long time ago, in my opinion. They haven't. It's really down to the wire right now, with the December 31st deadline looming really for both sides, and Jerome really summed it up for us pretty well. There are people who are confident also that there might be a deal after all, because things have taken a turn for the better compared to at least a couple of weeks ago. But we have heard officials from both sides saying, on the EU side, for example, in the words of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, their patience is running out. They're losing patience. And the British side, they're saying they're going to stick to their guns. And they're also accusing the European Union of obstructing progress towards a deal. So that blame game, if we will, is also ongoing. But they have indicated also at the same time that they are prepared to continue talking right through the week, through the weekend and beyond if necessary, hoping that there will be a deal. But again, it is unlikely that they will overcome those outstanding issues that Jerome enumerated, such as fisheries, despite the fact that fisheries, really fishing, constitutes not 0.6% of the UK's GDP, and the government has received criticism from certain quarters in the UK for insisting on that, as well as, again, the fair competition, the so-called level playing field, and how they're going to govern a deal should there be one. So on the one hand, you have the EU leaders saying they're frustrated and they are running out of patience, and you hear British officials saying, you know what, we prefer a deal, but if there isn't one, we are ready for a no-deal scenario. And if that happens, we all know that they're going to have to default to the WTO terms and conditions that will have costs for either side. Michel Barnier, the EU chief negotiator, has been received praise for trying to keep things smooth and calm, whereas when you look at the British side, they've been pretty aggressive and intransigent in their approach to the whole thing. The fact of the matter is that even in this home stretch of things, if there is a deal, I do not think they'll be able to meet the deadline, because the deal will have to be translated into the different European languages. Then it'll have to be signed off by the UK Parliament, the European Parliament, all of which is going to take time. In the recent past, some EU leaders have suggested, how about we agree on the outline of a deal, of the basic form of a deal, and then work on the details later. But it seems that that suggestion has been put on the back burner for now. So the race to the finish line is on, Bardia, but whether or not there will be a prize awaiting the two sides at the end, it's something that we'll have to wait and see with bated breath.
Jerome, what about the Irish border, which has also been one of the more essential parts of this divorce deal? How, for example, will the customs work in Boris Johnson's introduced NI protocol?
That's right, and that's something, Bardier, we haven't been hearing a lot about in recent times, because progress has been made on that issue. But there is fresh concern in relation to trying to preserve the Good Friday Peace Agreement, because the UK is going to publish its finance bill next week, and apparently there are components of that that the EU side, and particularly, I suppose, the Irish member of the European Union, is particularly concerned about in relation to, you know, exports from Northern Ireland to mainland Britain, and also VAT issues that could put pressure again on this whole issue of trying to prevent a hard border on Ireland, in Ireland. And so, yeah, it is one of those things that the UK side has been accused by the EU of using this whole, this very, very important issue of the Good Friday Agreement, the Belfast Agreement, to try and force the EU's hand and to give the UK side a better bargaining position. And again, with this finance bill, we need to get more details on that. It's kind of complex, but apparently that is raising fresh concerns. But, you know, I think the longer that the fact that these negotiations are still happening, and the fact that we've seen similar situations in the past when we had Greece almost falling out of the Eurozone, and, you know, different issues over, you know, refugee policy and, you know, security concerns that they had, and they found it very difficult to agree on many other things in the past. The fact that they're still talking, the fact that progress has been made on some key areas, gives us an indication that they more than likely will reach a deal. But as my good colleague in London has alluded to, time is running out, and it is going to be very difficult logistically to get everything passed in the Parliament in time for this deadline, the 31st of December. So will they have to introduce emergency legislation to, you know, give a sort of a further 1 month transition period to prevent these major delays on the borders? That's something that could be a possibility. Some people say it's not legally possible, but, you know, we've heard things so many times here in Brussels saying that things aren't possible, and then come the 11th hour, they are possible.
All right, thanks a lot, Jerome Hughes, our correspondent, joining us from Brussels. Also thanks to Saeed Purazov in London. Thank you for contributing to this segment of the program. Moving on, Britain has become the first country to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine for use. The UK government says a vaccine will be made available across the country from next week. Pfizer said Britain's approval of the vaccine marks a historic moment in the fight against the pandemic. The company said it anticipates more approvals. Therefore, it's now focusing on safely supplying a high-quality vaccine around the world. The UK is the worst-hit European country by the pandemic. It has registered over 1.6 million infections and more than 59,000 deaths.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines, now on the verge of being rolled out, insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for US and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of seven different vaccines.
A mass inoculation program is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia has reported its highest daily death toll from coronavirus with nearly 590 fatalities in the last 24 hours, a figure has pushed Russia's pandemic death toll to more than 41,000. The country on Wednesday registered over 25,000 new infections. That brings Russia's total confirmed cases to more than 2.3 million. In Germany, the Robert Koch Institute reported nearly 17,300 infections and over 480 deaths. Elsewhere in Europe, total COVID cases in Poland are nearing 1 million. The continent is facing a second wave of the disease. A number of countries have been posting record numbers of daily deaths and cases in the past month. The United States has recorded more than 2,500 coronavirus deaths in 24 hours. That's the highest daily toll since late April. The figure was reported by Johns Hopkins University on Tuesday. It registered over 180,000 new infections the same day. According to the university, the number of hospitalizations hit 99,000. That's a record as well. The situation is dire in several Midwestern states, including Indiana and South Dakota. Experts fear a new surge in infections several days after the Thanksgiving holiday that saw millions of Americans travel. Total COVID cases in the U.S. are above 13.7 million. Deaths have exceeded 270,000. Both are the highest in the world. Dwight Reed in Washington, D.C. says the coronavirus crisis in the U.S. is largely due to a lack of proper state response to the pandemic.
Well, of course, we're seeing from the get-go really a broad trend of inability and unwillingness to treat the pandemic from the top to the bottom, from the federal government to the state government to the local level. And of course, this larger trend of refusing to go along with the Thanksgiving guidelines in many cases, that's contributing to it. But of course, we have to understand that from the get-go, there has been no real state response, no real accountability or responsibility on that end, and it's all been on the individual.
The U.S. Justice Department says there's no proof of widespread fraud in the November 3rd presidential vote, further dimming Donald Trump's hopes of re-election. Attorney General William Barr said the department has not found fraud on a scale substantial enough to revoke Joe Biden's projected victory in the race. This is while Trump's personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani slammed Barr's remarks, accusing the Justice Department of failing to conduct proper probes. Giuliani vowed that the president's team will continue its legal fight. On Monday, Arizona and Wisconsin certified Biden's win, becoming the last of the six battleground states to do so. Trump insists that he won the race for the White House, but is being cheated out of victory. Colin Campbell says U.S. President Donald Trump's claims of widespread fraud in November 3rd election are only taken seriously by his diehard supporters.
And this is something that he's asserted after weeks of pretty much reporters and other officials saying that this is the conclusion that would inevitably happen, that the president really had no justification or evidence of there being rampant voter fraud across the country, that there are dead people voting, that there were illegal registrations, that the whole system is corrupt. All of this was said by the president to really electrify his base, that there was some wrongdoing and maybe to create some unrest that could help him stay in his position as president. But as we have observed, none of these processes or operations have been working for the president. He's really every day said that he's won the election, that the election is fraudulent, but there's been no evidence that's supporting any of this, and no one seems to be taking him seriously, except for maybe his diehard supporters. Other than that, most politicians are starting to accept that there's a transition happening. There are some Republicans who have been very quiet, but it's being reported that really they know deep down that the president lost the election, and they're just keeping quiet so as not to receive any wrath from the commander-in-chief. As we know, the president can be vindictive and vengeful. And I think that there are a lot of Republicans who are not showing or not exhibiting any bravery.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Inside Israel. Between 80,000 to 85,000 Israeli businesses are estimated to go out of business this year. That's an 85% rise since last year. Israeli businesses are desperate just to keep open and pay their liabilities, let alone earn an income.
People just want to fight for the right to provide, for the right to give the future for the children. What we are talking about, this is what they want, these small businesses. They don't have power to talk with the government. They don't have power to do nothing. Just they want to fight for the right of them.
Now, Israeli small business owners are despaired of the regime and are taking matters into their own hands. They are calling for civil disobedience against the regime in the form of defying lockdown measures. They are rebelling against the regime's lockdown as they fear a collapse of their business. Israel just got out of a second coronavirus lockdown in 2020. Many businesses were forced to shut down without compensation, leaving them exposed to financial risks. Many of them succumbed to those risks and have already closed. According to a survey published by U.S.-based business analytics firm Dun & Bradstreet, in the first half of the year, 37,600 businesses in Israel closed, including 1,500 cafes and restaurants and around 450 clothing and shoe stores. The number of closures in the first half of 2020 represents a 70% jump compared to the number of closures in 2019. The restaurant, construction, and transportation industries are among the worst hit, along with fashion stores. Before the coronavirus crisis, Israel had more than 14,000 restaurants, but after the first lockdown, that number fell below 12,000. Business owners say that this lockdown is catastrophic, as Israel went into the first lockdown not knowing what its results would be, but now they know they're destructive. The results of people coming in and out of quarantine and lockdowns are payments withheld, projects stalled, cash flow has ceased, and business owners cannot cover paychecks. According to the Israeli Hotel Association, instead of fighting the coronavirus and developing the economy, the regime has developed the virus and fought the economy. The regime's failure of passing a budget for 2020 has added unnecessary uncertainty in the face of the crisis. It is essential that a budget capable of adapting the tools at the disposal of the central bank to current challenges be approved as quickly as possible, according to the Israeli Central Bank. The political crisis between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his now coalition partner and military minister Benny Gantz has succeeded in yielding no agreement on a budget.
So the atmosphere really among business owners here in Israel is really despair. The business owners have lost a significant amount of their income, of their livelihoods. And unlike people who are employed, business owners actually have set amount of expenses that are still there, that they still have to pay in addition to the lack of income that they have. So their crisis, their economic crisis and their economic struggle is actually greater, in addition to the fact that the government doesn't have the same benefits and the same income security for freelance workers and for business owners. Business owners really have, I think, we can't really generalize, but I think the main sentiment towards what the government has been done is that they feel like they have been neglected, like they are not seen, like they are really just on the margin of the priorities of the government and of the authorities. I think everyone can say that. Everyone that lost their jobs can say that they are marginalized, that they're not being seen, and that there are no real solutions happening to these people. However, for business owners, that's especially true because most business owners actually lost lost any kind of source of income, and there are almost zero solutions provided by the government and by the new policies that are being enacted for the COVID-19 crisis. The estimate, I think the latest estimate is that one out of five businesses, small businesses, will close due to the pandemic. That's 20% of businesses, and that's 20% of families. That's tens of thousands of families that are not only losing their income, they're also losing, you know, their ability to actually secure any kind of income in the future. The uncertainty that this pandemic has presented to us has been unprecedented. We don't have actually any answers. We don't have a certainty of when this will end. We don't know when businesses will actually go back to normal. So that's a much harder crisis, a much harder situation to deal with as a business owner, because it's not like you have a certain period of time where you don't have a certain income and then you can plan accordingly.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Mark says this regime has killed many businesses, ruined many lives, and has probably caused a massive rise in crime. It has created normalization with others while neglecting normalization at home. Corruption, lies, and deceit are being reported. Where there is smoke, there must be fire. Arlene says synagogues open some schools, but Likud party Israel Katz, referring to Israeli Finance Minister Katz, and Netanyahu did what they could to injure without supporting business owners, shopkeepers, restaurants and cafes, the elderly, the poor, the families. The virus is not over yet. More lockdowns will be the future. Avi says Israeli Finance Minister Katz is a disgrace. The Israeli regime needed to provide financial compensation to the businesses harmed while incentivizing them to preserve public health. Columbus Jewish News says some large retail merchandise chains and small shops in Israel are defying the regime's restrictions and opening their doors in protest against the regime's lockdown, which has been disastrous for the economy and individual business owners.
Well, it looks like they've been very, very badly hit. The real problem is the strong divisions within Israeli society and the extraordinary concern by Netanyahu about international politics and his lack of real attention to a program for resuscitating and attending to the needs of the basic Israeli society.
Israel's decision in September to impose a second nationwide lockdown after a resurgence in coronavirus infections has dealt a hammer blow to the economy and the livelihoods of small business owners. Although the lockdown has ended, restaurants and other public places are not allowed to open. The Israeli regime is gradually allowing some to open and imposing fines for those that challenge the regime. Israeli small business owners are despaired of the regime and are taking matters into their own hands. They are calling for civil disobedience against the regime in the form of defying lockdown measures. They are rebelling against the regime's lockdown as they fear a collapse of their business. One of the organizers of this initiative is known as Lo Yehyeh Beseger, meaning there will be no lockdown in the Israeli Hebrew language. It has called on all small business owners in Israel to open their stores and services to the public. It was founded by a group of small business owners a few months ago and has since gained about 60,000 members over Facebook. It is not clear so far how many businesses have joined the rebellion. However, many stores and other small businesses considered non-essential during the pandemic have continued to operate in secret, behind curtains, or have closed doors, defying regime orders. Unrest is growing among small business owners who demand that their operations be allowed to resume right now. During the latest lockdown in Israel, small businesses were left with two choices: rebel against regime orders or tell their landlords they cannot make rent. Many worry that these restrictions will once more intensify. Business owners believe that the regime doesn't understand that businesses will fail another month like this, and according to Israeli media, it'll all be over. People who have nothing to lose will stay open.
The government actually has done close to nothing to help the people, to help the people and the business owners and employers and employees and everyone that actually has been impacted by this pandemic, economically, socially, and politically. I think the government has really been very, very, very negligent. It's been very disconnected from the needs of the people. It's been very preoccupied with other things. We can see that, you know, many tycoons and millionaires are getting millions of shekels in tax exemptions and tax discounts, where this money could go very easily to education, to health, to welfare, and to business owners. And I think that the fact that this government has failed in really coping with this pandemic and with this crisis really also represents the bigger picture of the system and of the priorities of this government. It's not, the pandemic didn't create the problems. I think it just put the problems on the front where we could actually see them very clearly. It surfaced the problems. It surfaced the years and years of neglecting, of under-budgeting for the different systems that we have. So now we're after the end of a partial end of the second closure
And I think that you could see that smaller businesses are starting to open again. What is sad is that you see that not all of them are opening. If you go just right down here on Mikveh Israel in Tel Aviv, right under our office, you could see that there are, I think, around 10 shops in the street here, and you could see that two of them actually closed completely. They just didn't make it. And it's very, very sad to see that, to think that this small business belonged to a family, belonged to a mother or to a father, and they just lost their income. They lost their business, and they probably have had that business for years. So some businesses actually did decide to protest and open their businesses despite the closure, despite the instructions of not opening them. That's also because they are... It's a sign of protest. It's a sign of, you know, we're not agreeing with these policies. You cannot choose our health over our livelihood or our livelihood over our health. The government's responsibility is to make sure that we are also healthy, which absolutely justifies the closures and the limitations. However, when you decide to do that, it's the government's responsibility and it should be its priority to make sure that these people do not starve, that the people who are affected by these closures do not actually lose their source of income.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Handicapper Bill says Netanyahu screwed up like his bosom buddy Trump. A2P says even before the coronavirus pandemic, Israel had one of the largest income gaps and poverty rates. A second nationwide virus lockdown has widened those gaps, dealing a new blow to an economy already hit hard by the first round of restrictions. Avi says restaurants also had a responsibility to act responsibly. Too many did not extend outdoor seating, did not have them or staff wear masks, and did not take health or safety measures. Yes, they should have an economic safety net, but they need to take responsibility as well. According to Anne, what is the evidence people were getting sick in restaurants? We have no data. Infuriating.
The Bibi regime has taken over so much of our solidness, our proper life, livelihood here in this country, and we don't feel like we have democracy anymore. We feel that for escaping the law, he's going to be stuck there, and we are going to be stuck forever in a state of some kind of a new monarchy. That's what we feel we have here.
No, we have to separate between the protest, which is growing and which is now lasting for many, many weeks, which is namely directed at Netanyahu and has namely to do with the charges of corruption that he is confronting. This is one episode. Corona and business who cannot open or rebellious is another episode. They not necessarily mix together. The core or the majority of the protests against Netanyahu, the demonstrations which take place almost every evening and for sure every weekend, those protests are mainly political protests against Netanyahu without any connection to the economy or to the pandemic.
Israel is slowly opening up businesses again, but it's been months since they were required to close that it won't have meaningful impact on the economy. Israel's GDP contracted by 28.7% in the second quarter of 2020. That is the sharpest decline in 40 years, according to a report released by the Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics. This while private consumption fell 43.4% in the second fiscal quarter. Israel's debt-to-GDP ratio in 2020 is expected to reach some up to 80%. In September, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, forecast that Israel's economy is expected to contract 6% this year. Israel's economy was showing signs of instability even before the coronavirus pandemic. In fact, there was a political deadlock for about a year that shook the economy, and then the pandemic dealt the final blow. For now, many Israelis say that they've lost hope and trust in the regime and its failure to help them. Here's the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. Some 22.7% of Israelis, 938,000 people, were unemployed at the height of the second coronavirus lockdown, according to the Central Bureau of Statistics, Calculus reported. The statistics refer to the first half of October and are based on a poll of the workforce. Ynet News. Israeli Knesset member Betalel Smutrich called for Israel to apply sovereignty over the occupied West Bank before the next U.S. presidential term begins, in the event Democrat nominee Joe Biden wins the 2020 presidential elections. Polls say over 60% of Israelis favor the Republican president over Biden, the former vice president in the Obama administration. I-24 News. Israeli armed forces destroyed the homes of some 80 Palestinians it said were built without permit in the occupied West Bank. The United Nations has called the move the largest demolition operation conducted in over a decade. Bulldozers knocked down livestock enclosures, portable toilets, solar panels, and water containers in an operation that stretched into the night. Globes. Israel's fiscal deficit reached 10.1% of GDP for the 12 months to the end of October, the Ministry of Finance announced. This represents a rise of about 1% from September. The cumulative deficit for January to October 2020 is 122.7 billion new Israeli shekels. In the corresponding period last year, the deficit totaled 37.8 new Israeli shekels. The Ministry of Finance said in response to the deficit figure, the regime's expenditure has risen, tax revenues have fallen, among other things, contributed to the large deficit.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لعلك ترى أن الله إنما خلق هذا العالم الواحد وترى أن الله لم يخلق بشرا غيركم بلى والله لقد خلق الله ألف ألف عالم وألف ألف آدم أنت في آخر تلك العوالم وأولئك الآدميين.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "Perhaps you think that Allah has only created a single world, and you think that Allah has not created anyone other than yourselves. Nay, by Allah, verily Allah has created a million worlds and a million atoms, and you are in the last of these worlds and of the last atoms."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So discussing some of these dialogues and conversations that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam had, we find a very interesting discussion that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has with one of his students by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi. Now, in this discussion between Imam al-Baqir and Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, we find that Imam al-Baqir gives Jabir some very interesting and very high moral standards and ideals through which humanity and human beings can become perfect. They can become sublime if they are to put them into effect. Now, the following is one of them. Imam al-Baqir says, "Know that you are not our friend when you become sad, when all the people of your city say that you are an evil man." So here, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, before we continue, is saying that if you are one of the friends of the Ahl al-Bayt, then don't become sad when the people of your city or everybody around you says that you are an evil man, when in reality you are a good person. So you are a good person, but for some reason, people don't like good people, unfortunately. But you are a good person and still the people of your city call you an evil man. You should not become sad at this. Rather, you should be proud and you should be happy and you should thank Allah that you are a good person. In continuation, Imam al-Baqir says, "If they saw that you are a righteous man, then that should not delight you." Meaning, if the people say that you are so good and you are so pious and we love you so much, that should not delight you. Yes, you should thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for all honor and respect is from Allah. But do not make this praise from the people make you arrogant. And finally, Imam al-Baqir says, "For what people say against you or for you neither harms you nor benefits you." Very beautiful words in this dialogue that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has with his student Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi. We learn so many beautiful lessons from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Quran and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. Imam explained it further by saying, إِنَّمَا الْإِنْفَهَا بِمَنْزِلَةِ دَجَاجَةٍ مَيْتَةٍ أُخْرِجَتْ مِنْهَا بَيْضًا. Imam said, if you want to understand why this rennet, this enzyme known as rennet, is still halal, although it comes from an animal which was not zabiha, Imam says the example would be of an egg which comes from a dead chicken. The chicken was dead and they cut it up and they say there is an egg in there. Imam says that is the example. Although the chicken is dead, it was not slaughtered. You can't eat that chicken, but this halal, this egg is okay. So Imam asked him, فَهَلْ تَأْكُلْ تُؤْكَلْ تِلْكَ الْبَيْضَ? Can that egg be eaten? Qatada says, لا ولا أمر بي أكلها. No, because the egg is coming from a maita, from a dead chicken. So I will not eat it, and I'll not even allow or, you know, give permission for somebody who follows me to eat it. And Imam says, why? Why would you do that? He says, well, because it is coming from maita, from a dead chicken. So then Imam said, okay, suppose we keep that egg, and it hatches and there is a chicken coming out of that egg. Are you going to eat that? Wo chooza jo hai usko khaoge ki nahi soup bana ke? And then he says, well, if the egg is hatched and a chick comes out when a chicken baby comes in from that, yeah, I'll eat that. So Imam said, you know, what made the egg haram and the chicken which came from the egg halal for you? You know, this is how Imam basically explained that although the dead chicken was maita, but the egg is still okay. Similarly, the cow might be maita, not zabiha, but the enzyme which is now known as rennet is still halal and pak for us.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.